Superchargers, headlights, and more. With over 122 million parts, eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Stay on your A-game with all the parts you need at the prices you want. It's easy to bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com. Thompson, and you're listening to Dark Side of the Podcast. I'm sure you were probably expecting a little Grill and JR, but that's tomorrow. We figured since we're all quarantined, why not talk about our favorite new wrestling show? Of course, we're talking about Dark Side of the Ring Season 2. It's brought to you by Vice every single Tuesday night at 10 p.m. Check your local listings. But last night, we had quite the episode. I'm excited to talk about it, but I couldn't do that without the creators of the show, Jason and Evan. But Evan, today we've got a special guest. It's not just a triple threat. It's a fatal four-way. Who do we have with us today?
That is right. We have our story producer, Howard Sheffman, here joining us for this special episode on Herb Abrams. Say hello, Howard.
Hello, everyone. Hi.
He's also our secret weapon, I would say.
Hey, I'll take it.
Howard has been with us since season one of the show, and he is definitely a vital part of producing the show. He does a lot of the research. He reaches out to a lot of the subjects. He helps us through legal turmoils. He instills us with passion. He holds us together. He keeps us on the schedule. Any of the times where we actually think about quitting, he brings us back. So yeah, Howard is a vital part of the show, but the main reason we wanted to have him on this week is because Howard actually really was the mastermind behind this episode, and we basically tasked him with like running with the Herb Abrams ball, if you will, and so he went really deep in terms of talking to all the subjects you see on screen. Tons of subjects you see that weren't interviewed, and did all the research, put it all together so we could tackle this episode. And I would say that Howard, I'm going to call you Herb because it's just now it's.
Oh, it's happened. It has been a lot of people keep calling me Herb now. It's a problem.
Well, Howard, I think might be the single-handedly the most knowledgeable person on the Herb Abrams story that's alive, that's still alive. And so that's why we thought bringing him on the show this week would help, tell tons of different stories about the making of this Gonzo episode of the show.
Well, Evan, let's start at the beginning. How did we land on the decision to do a UWF story in the first place?
That's a good question. So in the very beginning of the Dark Side of the Ring saga, when Jason and I were pitching this show and putting it together, developing it, I decided to reach out to, a bunch of different wrestling historians, wrestling people like in the community who've done lots of interviews with other wrestlers prior, just because I wanted to find out what were the most insane stories out there that we could tell for the show. And when I was putting this all together, I reached out to Sean Oliver, who is the fellow behind Kayfabe Commentaries, mainly because Jason and I had been a fan of those Kayfabe Commentary DVDs. We bought so many of them and watched them and took notes and were inspired by a lot of the crazy road stories that have come up on those in the past. So I just figured that, Sean must have heard some crazy stories in his time talking to all these guys. And what would his suggestion be if we were to do this documentary series about wrestling? And the one that he basically the only story that he really provided and was rather insistent upon it was the story of Herb Abrams and the UWF. And I have to be honest, I'd never heard of any of it before. It was totally a blind spot in my wrestling fandom. And so basically, you know, he obviously led with the story of Herb Abrams' death. Like, how could you forget that? And I actually put the Herb Abrams story as a potential subject that we could cover if the series were to get greenlit. So it was actually in the original pitch materials for the show. And once we then were off to the races making the Bruiser Brody episode, and once we were making season one, for whatever reason, we didn't make it. We didn't make the Herb episode. I don't know why. I don't really have a good answer for that, to be honest with you.
I think honestly it was because, like, at the time it was like the story that we just couldn't find out anything about. Like,
well, that's true.
With every one of our episodes, we do our own like preliminary like research on it. I feel like there just wasn't like enough information for us to really like sink our teeth into as much as the other stories at that time.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, there wasn't a lot of information out there on the internet. And I feel like once we got wrapped up in season one and we were just kind of like, cause this is really one of the first times we had signed up to do something so, you know, intense, you know, and making six documentaries at the same time, that I don't think there was a lot of room for us to like stop and research something like that, like as much heavy lifting that needed at the time. So long story short, we finished season one and Sean Oliver actually asked me to be on his podcast, just to, you know, interview, talk to me about making season one. And I went on there, and I think the whole reason I was on the show was just so he could actually grill me about why we didn't do the Herb Abrams story for season one. Like, I like, you had one job, you know, you had one job. I told you what it should have been and you didn't do it. Why didn't you do it? The world doesn't need another Montreal screw job documentary. The world needs this Herb Abrams story. What's wrong with you? And so I didn't. And then of course, in that, while he was cutting the promo, he was listing all the reasons why it was such a perfect fit for Dark Side of the Ring, but also a fit for Vice. And I really couldn't argue with it. I had nothing. I froze. There was nothing I could really say. He was right. And at this point in time, we were just starting work on season two. And so what I did is I was like, you know, I had this nagging feeling and just like this in the pit of my stomach. And I was like, man, he's right. We really should do this because maybe there really is something here. And we were right at that time when we were kind of deciding what the episodes were going to be for season two. And I walked into the office. And Howard, if you can back me up, I believe made some sort of mini announcement that we are going to officially tackle this for season two. We should at least look into it. And then you did.
Yeah, I'm going to actually correct you. It was a phone call because I distinctly remember, it's very funny. I remember you I was in the office. I get a call from you, and which is, you know, normal, but just like very energetic and just like, I just got off this podcast. Do you know about Herb Abrams? I have no idea what you're talking about. And you just went off about, like, again, the bones of what this story is and how, yeah, we have to do the story. Is there a story here? And then I think that was like in the fall. And then basically every day since then has been Herb Abrams all the time for me.
Yeah, every day. Yeah, exactly. So then, yeah, we were off to the races.
Well, it's quite a story, but unfortunately it's one that I think a lot of people who watch this show probably heard for the very first time. Maybe that's fortunately, but the Twitter activity we saw last night was incredible, with so many people hearing this story for the very first time. It is sort of, I don't know, is underground the right word, or how would you describe this fantastic story of Herb Abrams and the missteps of the UWF, Evan?
Yeah, so I kind of describe this story, and just for the layman, for someone who's not as familiar with the story like I was, but I've always kind of described it as Boogie Nights, you know, meets the Fyre Festival of Wrestling, where essentially you have this enigmatic, very impressionable, charismatic individual, Herb Abrams, who is a wrestling fan at his heart. And he basically decides that he wants to start his own wrestling federation. And he's able to actually seduce and get people to subscribe to his vision and his lofty dreams of doing so. And then you have an impressive roster of guys, you know, as we saw, you know, Paul Orndorff, Mick Foley, Dr. Death, Steve Williams, you know, heck, even Andre the Giant basically subscribe to this dream and they're along for the ride. But then everyone starts to have their slow burn rude awakening of what's really going on here. And, oh, this is a vanity project gone wild. And, you know, checks are bouncing and audience members aren't showing up. And what the hell is going on here? And then obviously it concludes with the most spectacular, you know, outrageous passing of any individual that I've ever heard of in my time.
It's such a fascinating story. And you mentioned, you know, that this is a guy who wants to start his own promotion, but we hear about a meeting where maybe that wasn't the original plan. Howard, what did you learn about Abrams meeting with Vince McMahon?
Yeah, I mean, so I've actually, again, like basically everything in this story, I've heard four different versions of his meeting with Vince McMahon. But the one that seems from people I've talked to who apparently were at this meeting, Herb basically conned his way into a meeting with Vince McMahon. Like he had become with an assistant of Vince's or someone working with Vince. I'm not sure exactly who that was. And Herb got this meeting and he sits down and Vince basically says, "So what are you here for?" And Herb tries to sell himself. He tries to sell like wrestling and he wants to take over the West Coast and he'll do this and he'll do that. And again, from a close friend of Herb's, he told me that this was probably the only person who Herb ever came across who didn't buy Herb shtick. Like the only guy who didn't fall for Herb's charm is Vince McMahon, which I love.
Yeah. That's a story in and of itself. And you know, it doesn't go well. And so I sort of wonder, Jason, I think me and you've talked about this before, but you're a fan of Curb Your Enthusiasm, right?
I don't know if we've talked about that before.
How could you not be, first of all?
Well, yeah, come on.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Well, so here's the deal. I have a theory.
I may have only seen a couple episodes of that show, to be honest.
Well, this past season, they had an episode, or I guess the whole theme was Larry being upset at another business. And he opened up a spite store right next door. I feel like the UWF is Herb Abrams' spite store for Vince McMahon.
Oh my God. Yeah. And when you see like the lengths in which he went to try and I think like kind of stick it to Vince McMahon, like we highlight a couple of them and they're very inspirational.
There's so many more. Like yeah. Just one I'll throw out there is, I've been told that Herb would call or fax Titan Sports with offers to buy the WWF. Like there was not going to happen. It was not an actual, it was just that he wanted Vince McMahon to see that someone was trying to buy it. And it was Herb Abrams. Like he would do anything just to like rattle Vince. And John says it in the episode, John Arizzi says like pretty much just for his own enjoyment, this like sick fun of his.
Yeah. And like one thing I was going to throw onto that, like you can kind of like, I'm actually asking you this, Howard, but like, is it sort of safe to say that like, because he was shut out from Vince, you know, because Vince didn't entertain his lofty vision, that essentially that started the trajectory of her being on this kind of, you know, this forward momentum with really trying to crush and put, you know, Vince out of business. Isn't that safe to say?
Yeah, it does. It seems like that. It seems like if Vince had seen something in Herb and saw potential in him, we could have seen a new flunky for Vince McMahon. Like it could have been a whole different story. Because at the end of the day, Herb charmed so many people. There are like from the most like powerful people you've ever heard of to people on the street, Herb was charming to all of them. And if that had worked with Vince, I think we would have been telling a very different story here.
Wow.
It's such a character. And one of the other things, one of my favorite things in the show period was the explanation of how the belt worked, with regards to the side plates. Evan, what can you tell us about this?
The belt is amazing. Conrad's referring to is the Sports Channel America belt that we all saw last night, you know, that says FU when you hold it up, which is kind of amazing. Cause it really shows
You know, Herb's sense of humor, which I think is kind of undersold throughout the story. Not only within the what that belt represented, but also the fact that his dog's name is Cokie, I also figure out is pretty hilarious. But anyway, one of the amazing things about the UWF is just the sheer number of belts that they actually had. It was something that we didn't actually have the runtime to get into last night. But Howard, aren't you like a scholar on the number of UWF belts that are out there?
And this is the thing. We have the line where just Herb loved belts. He loved designing them. He loved getting them made. And there's a bunch around there, like Rick Allen, Sunny Beach. He has, I think, two of them. There's a few people kind of scattered around. Like Lenny has the Sports Channel America belt, and these are kind of everywhere. But yeah, there was the UWF Americas Championship. There was the UWF Intercontinental Heavyweight Championship. We can all remember the UWF Israeli Championship that went to Joshua Ben-Gurion. The UWF Junior Heavyweight Championship, the UWF MGM Grand Championship, the UWF Midget World Championship, the UWF North American Championship, the UWF Southern States Championship, the UWF Sports Channel Television Championship, the UWF World Women's World Championship, the UWF World Heavyweight Championship, and finally, the UWF World Tag Team Championship. And again, this is a promotion that lasted like one full year and then maybe three or four events after that.
Pretty remarkable. And Rick Allen has the World Midget Championship as well, which I have a photograph of, which is incredible.
Well, let's talk about, you know, you refer to it as the Sports Channel belt. You actually wound up talking to a lot of folks who didn't make the final cut here, Howard, including some folks from the TV station, right?
Yeah, I talked to a number of guys who were like heavily involved from the network up until like to the point of like they were the guys who were in the arena, the small spaces with Herb when they were actually filming the matches. And it's just wild. Like they loved him. Again, it's that charm. Every guy I talked to would say, yeah, he stiffed me. Yeah, he like that money went away quickly, but he was so great. And one guy I spoke to, his name is Michael Lardner, and he was the senior VP executive producer at Sports Channel America. And Herb came into the pitch meeting with Paul Orndorff and he sold them on the big names that he'd be bringing in. And like, it was just Herb would get in a room and you just want to give him your money. And he also remembered the cookies. A lot of those guys remember the cookies. That's for sure.
Did we ever get confirmation that the cookies were like something, you know, on the open market you could buy and you could actually purchase, or were they just kind of proof of concept at the time?
I am going to say probably proof of concept, because the only people who ever can say that they had them are kind of the network guys who they remember getting the boxes mailed and like, again, rave reviews. Michael Lardner and his wife both remember the cookies and were that was one of the fonder memories of their time with Herb. But yeah, those Sports Channel people, that to them, it was a small investment. They were kind of a growing like cable network and they wanted wrestling and Herb. I mean, there was a couple other people who had potential to be in that spot and Herb sold them with Paul Orndorff, with just all those kind of big names he was working with at the time and got connected to.
Speaking of big names, Evan, you guys had one of the biggest names in the history of the business, who was also a part of the UWF participating in this, the former Cactus Jack, friend of the program, Mick Foley. What was it like working with Mick this season?
Well, it was just great having Mick back. I mean, you know, we worked with Mick on the Bruiser Brody pilot, who was just an amazing collaborator, because, you know, Mick was chosen to narrate that episode because of his personal, you know, connection to Bruiser Brody. He idolized Bruiser Brody. And, you know, Mick was just so involved in like the writing of that narration. And he took every word that we wrote and made it better. And he was just so awesome to work with him. And it was such a great experience that Jason and I had. And we were really hoping to find another way to work together. And it was when this idea of doing the UWF episode came about, it was like, well, maybe, you know, we can ask Mick and maybe he'll say yes. Maybe he'll want to do this. And I really had no idea what like Mick's take was on this whole story. And so I wrote him an email and just kind of saying like pitching the idea. And he wrote me back instantaneously. and was like, yes, I'm in. And then we were really off to the races then when, you know, we had Mick be a part of this. And as you saw in the episode last night, he's so funny. And Mick had some of the more memorable lines of the whole season, in my opinion. And it was really cool just to hear his perspective, because I think he adds so much to the episode in terms of, like, you know, the fact that he attributes his time period in the UWF as that real kind of experimental phase in his career where, you know, because he wasn't wrestling, you know, like, as he says, with handcuffs on as he was in WCW, UWF, probably mainly because of some of the naivete and that it was a smaller company, they didn't have a lot of creative control over their wrestlers. So it let people like Mick really kind of find themselves. And I think he really found, you know, a lot of creative freedom in developing that Cactus Jack character and some of the other faces of Foley that he would go on to portray. And I think he really attributes that to the time he had in UWF, where he had so much freedom, which is just amazing that there's such a net positive to have out of this whole crazy nightmare that is the UWF.
Howard, what do you make of the, I mean, the way people talk about Herb is almost like, yeah, he was full of shit, but we love him. I mean, it feels like there's some really, I don't know, nasty stories here to be told that aren't exactly glowing or positive or productive. It just feels like a lot of bad, but when people talk about him, they talk about him so lovingly. Is that what you discovered when you interviewed most folks for this?
I want to say that one of the challenges of this episode was properly, like, getting to the audience, like, how the wrestling isn't really good and how much of a shit show the whole thing was. Just because we talked to a ton of people and it was hard for that. Even Mick Foley, who's like, he obviously went on to become one of the greatest of all times. And like, to get them to talk poorly about this promotion that, like, if you want to watch, it's all online and it's not great. It's unquestionably a lot of bad wrestling and production went into that. And these guys had nothing but good things to say about him. Like one major thing about this episode that I think we tried to show is how all these guys, they thought they were close to Herb, and maybe they were briefly, but ultimately he was scamming them one way or another. And when I say scamming, it's in a weird way, he's like, wasn't always hurting people. For some, he was clearly keeping elements of his life and his past close to the vest. And sorry to jump ahead, but I think it's one of the reasons why everyone's story about his death is different. And it's why people in the episode still think that he could be alive. Like, he convinced people that they were going to the top with him. And even when they didn't go to the top, they didn't hold it against him. And that's a weird quality that I don't think many people have.
Well, yeah, I was just going to throw onto that too, is it's like, it's really interesting. Something that I didn't expect when we were filming these interviews is, you know, going in that, you know, Herb bounced checks on these guys, you know, that they weren't always paid. They weren't settled. They're still owed money, you know, and all this stuff. And normally in the wrestling industry, like in the wrestling industry or any other industry, that's met with malice or bitterment. You know, people would hold on to that, I feel like. But with him, with Herb, and it's like, most of these guys have experienced bounce checks from Herb, but at the same time, for the most part, they're still very emotional about his death, and they were really endeared by this guy, and they still like this guy, and, like, you know, even though all these crazy shady things went down, it's like even Brian Blair mentions, which is, I think, is something we should get into, because we didn't really have the runtime for it in the episode, is to kind of talk about the, you know, where does the money come from in this situation, right? And like even Brian Blair, who introduced a financier into this equation, like he actually introduced, I think it was a friend of his, right, Howard?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like a friend of his who had some money to invest, and he put some money into UWF. Herb sold him on it. And then here comes some, you know, here comes cash from this guy. And of course, right after that, Brian Blair is seeing, you know, effectively all this go up his nose, you know, like he's seeing the cocaine, he's seeing the hookers, he's also seeing, you know, checks bounce, and he's also seeing Herb take people out for these enormous dinners and paying for all this booze and everything. And, you know, Brian's just sitting there knowing that this is all, you know, coming from his buddy's paycheck, or sorry, his buddy's wallet.
And it's like, oh my God, you know? And so it's like, but even then Brian gets emotional talking about Herb's passing and considers Herb a close friend. And you know,
and Brian, sorry. And Brian has the line in the episode of he, it was other people's money, but if it was still, if it was his money, I think he still would do the same. And I feel like that encapsulates right. how they think about Herb.
Exactly. So I think all of this is just really indicative of the fact that, you know, Herb's charm, you know, runs deep.
Talk to me a little bit about that, because, you know, the only line that we know it's not his own money, because it's sort of alluded to that it really was his own money because he made plus size dresses or plus size dresses. and I sort of bought into that, but then you hear Brian Blair say, no, it was other people's money. When did Herb's money stop and investor money begin? Do you know, Howard?
Like everything Herb, I've heard 400 versions of it. It really seems, I talked to a close friend, like a really close friend of Herb's near the end of this whole process, who really explored a lot of the stuff that, like kind of about Herb's early days. And the oversized women's clothing, I'm a big girl now, that store was one of 14 stores that Herb had in his time. And he had, like, it was all clothing stores, and they were in New York, they were LA, and he would open one, he'd close one, he'd have money, he wouldn't have money. And like, Herb's charm got him investors, and the one Brian spoke to us about is one of them. And starting the UWF, he got from other money from other people. He got some from Sports Channel America. But like, was there a time when the UWF was funded by Herb Abrams himself? It's possible, but I wouldn't put money on it.
Well, the other thing too you hear about in the episode that's also kind of on this subject is when, you know, Marty's story, when they're running the show in North Dakota, right? Wasn't that where it is, or
South Carolina?
Right. When they're running the show in South Carolina, and the TV crew is expecting to get paid, and then, you know, Herb puts him on the phone, you know, and has them talk to the bank of, you know, with his personal banking information, saying that there's money there. But when in fact the bank account that he's writing the check with, which is the UWF money, there's nothing there. So that's also touched on a little bit as well. And, you know, from what I recall too, and maybe I'm just speculating, but, that, you know, that Herb, you know, kind of got this thing rolling with the money that he had from mm-hmm. I'm a big girl now. And then I think as it was running its course, and maybe as he had these different stops and starts, you know, with when the Sports Channel deal, you know, was over, because that was only a year long contract, right? Yep. And then he goes into these other kind of relaunching UWFs. He's probably bringing on other investors and selling them in it. And I do also remember from the Brian Blair thing too, that it was like his family friend that was investing in the UWF. And I think it was like his son, like this guy's son, was kind of managing the money, like as it was being like sent to Herb. And don't quote me on this, I'm just recalling this from the interview. But then it was like this guy found out that his son was giving Herb like way more money than
I think it was his brother.
His brother, right. Okay, sorry. His brother, yeah, it was like, was actually greenlighting, giving Herb way more money than this guy thought he had even agreed to in the beginning. And then you kind of wonder, like, oh my gosh, like this money, I mean, you see in the episode where this money is probably actually going. And I think that was a huge source of, I think it even caused that family to kind of be torn apart a little bit, right? Didn't he get divorced over that whole thing? Or so, yeah. So there was definitely some stuff that happened there that was definitely not good. That was no bueno.
And sorry, that just reminded me, there is, so Herb definitely did have money at some point. There is rumor, a lot of people said it might, he was married to a woman, for a while, who they thought it might've been her money, because everyone talks about when they first meeting Herb, when he was in LA, he was living in Beverly Hills, like in a beautiful house. He drove a fancy car. So what that money was from, we still don't know, but there definitely was a point in which he had money and was very happy to show it off. But yeah, where that went or how he got it will remain a mystery.
Herb, if this was an American Greed episode about Herb, we would have some sort of tally. Do you have any sort of idea how much money he lost on this venture?
I don't think you could. It's just the promotion was announced in 1990. He started running shows in Los Angeles in the late 90s.
into 91, where he goes to New York, and then he does shows in Florida. He does one in North Dakota, one in South Carolina, and he does the Blackjack Brawl in Las Vegas. And like, none of those shows made money for him. And so, and to end it all on the Blackjack Brawl at the MGM Grand, like that alone, who knows how much he personally lost there. So there'll be no, yeah, it is just lost to time, unfortunately.
Let's talk about Blackjack Brawl. One of the more iconic shows of its sort. And one of the things that he pulls off before we talk about the MGM Grand is, and Jason helped me out here, allegedly he got an appearance for Dr. Death on the Tonight Show with Jay Leno to promote this pay-per-view. And I've never seen footage of that. I mean, is this rumor and innuendo? Did this actually happen?
I can't recall, Howard. Do you know if there was footage of that?
Oh, I know. I spent a couple weeks. Oh no, that's my white whale. Anyone listening to this podcast, if you can find me that clip, I will owe you forever, because it happened. Basically what the bit is Dr. Death. It's like a Jay Leno was shooting in Las Vegas, and in one of the episodes from that week, Dr. Death is in the audience and challenges Jay to a match, and they kind of growl at each other. And then I believe Dr. Death challenges Hulk Hogan to a match. It's kind of just 20 seconds of footage. But long story short, NBC refused to find us the material. I was able to give them the date it happened. I gave an explanation of what the moment would be, and if we weren't able to physically show them what we wanted, they wouldn't find it for us. And it doesn't exist online, and you'd be surprised to find out there aren't a lot of Jay Leno internet fans, so that didn't help us either.
somebody somewhere has a collection of Tonight Show VHSs. I'm just sure of it.
I've talked to tape, there was a tape trader who was involved in the show who, like, he's really in that world. He's found some really interesting wrestling things and other stuff. And I asked him to ask the community, and nothing came back on that. But one thing about that appearance I want to mention is Steve Ray, who's a pretty big standout in the episode. He tells me the reason that happened is he was, and this is the number one scene I wanted to make a recreation of that we didn't get to do, is he was in an elevator in Las Vegas, and he sees Jay Leno in the elevator, and he starts pitching about Herb and about the UWF and this pay-per-view, or this not a pay-per-view, this event. And Jay gives him his card, and then in the hotel room, him and Dr. Death flip a coin of who gets to appear on the show, and Dr. Death wins. And I really wanted to just show that meeting on the elevator as, like, we just see the chin in shadows.
Oh. It's funny. Like, I guess, like, Lenny, who worked at NBC as, like, a post-production, like, wasn't he the head of post-production at NBC for 25 years? They wouldn't even let him have access to something like that.
That's fine. Well, so we don't talk about it too much in the episode, but Lenny wasn't involved at the time of the Blackjack Brawl. Like, that was a time when he had given Herb kind of an ultimatum where you have to get clean or I can't work for you anymore. And the Blackjack Brawl was one of maybe two events alongside the North Dakota show that Lenny was not involved in at all. So maybe he does have a copy somewhere, but NBC nowadays, they do not want to give it to us.
And Lenny is a fascinating character, like, in the whole, you know, UWF story and trajectory, because, you know, Lenny's the straight man, right? Like, Lenny's the guy who I think constantly was having to hold this whole shit show together. You know, anytime that, you know, Herb would be off disappearing, you know, doing drugs and being with women and partying when he should be focusing on these events. I think that if it weren't for Lenny, the UWF wouldn't have gotten nearly as far as it did. And it was just like such an amazing thing for us to get Lenny to appear in the episode, because I think he adds so much to this story. And again, it's like another emotional voice too. I mean, this is a guy who collaborated with Herb. He considers him a best friend, and, you know, he was torn up about his passing too. And, you know, he was really upfront right in the beginning of the interview saying, like, all the things you read about Herb and all the stuff you hear about his death and, like, the tabloid nature of it all, like, you know, it's true, but you know, I want to tell you about the Herb that I knew, you know, and he had a whole nother side to this, you know, that like he was a generous person and, you know, they were really close as friends, but you know, Lenny was a guy who constantly, I think, had to drag Herb out of these wild situations, these wild party situations, smack him around, you know, a little bit and get him to sober up so they could continue this wild and crazy dream.
Yeah, Lenny is very much like the unsung hero, or at least like I think people will like him so much because he is that, like, he is like a good friend. Like he tries to be a good friend and he's just like, I don't know, such a great example.
Even when he wouldn't work for Herb, he was still calling and checking in and making sure he was okay. Like he was that kind of guy. Like, I can't do business with you. And to be clear, Lenny was never paid a dime working for Herb Abrams. That was all on his own expense and doing it because he loved Herb and wanted to get in wrestling. That was the dream. And he was there for Herb in any way he could until he couldn't anymore.
Wow.
Well, it feels like he couldn't anymore after the Blackjack Brawl. And when we say he, we mean Herb Abrams. This is sort of the last hurrah. What can you tell us about the Blackjack Brawl and how this comes to, not the best end?
Well, the one thing I'll say about the Blackjack Brawl is obviously, you know, I don't quote me on this, but I believe the MGM Grand holds at least, you know, anywhere between 12 and 14,000 people, right? And something to that effect.
Evan, then I can give you the exact number. So
I'm not surprised you can. What is it?
Let's just be clear. So there were 15,109 tickets printed for the Blackjack Brawl. And would you like to know how many tickets were purchased?
Please.
640.
But now, can I correct you on that? Because is this 604 or whatever number based upon what Herb had reported?
No, this is from the David Bixenspan had sent us the Nevada State Athletic Commission report for the Blackjack Brawl, which is a crazy document to look at. And this is from the official document, is 640. And again, who knows how many of those Herb paid for, but
there
640 out of a total of 15,000 tickets that were printed for that event.
So 604, but like it still could be an embellishment on how many actual butts were in seats, though, right? Like 604 seems very liberal to what you see on screen.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And again, like most of those tickets were the $12 tickets. And we don't know how many of those people were comped and given in the casino, because that's how he clearly was trying to get people to come to the event. But it was a disaster of, I don't think anything can compare to that.
And I have to just include that I just love Mick Foley's, you know, like, you know, he, again, like, you're like, wow, Herb pulled off the MGM Grand. Maybe this is the time that we've been waiting for. Maybe he might just do it this time. And then, of course, you know, Mick's amazing story about going up to his hotel room suite. And then when, you know, Herb unveils these cowboy boots as really the most important thing of the show, then you really know you're in trouble. And I just love that scene. And one of the little fun little facts about that scene is the actor that we had to play Mick Foley in the reenactments actually just no-showed. It was one of the only times we've ever had an actor just completely no-show. Totally no-showed. So we had to get Jason Eisner suited up to play Mick Foley in that scene. So
yeah. I never thought that I would have to double Foley, but you know, you can convince
Then of course Howard played Lenny in all of the reenactment scenes that you see of Lenny trying to get Herb Abrams, you know, sober. You're trying to get him to sober up, and that was you.
Yeah, I mean, so fans can know, I tried to get into every episode I could. I think I'm in like four or five. But yeah, if I had it my way, I would have played John Stossel. I would have played, I played Earl Hebner in season one. I mean, trust me, I was working real hard to get my face there. Yeah,
we had you played a referee in a lot of episodes too.
Well, Earl Hebner, yeah.
No,
yeah.
But also I'm the referee in Dino Bravo. I'm the referee in Brawl for All. I am nothing but not wanting to be on camera. I just want to add a couple more Blackjack Brawl things we couldn't get in the episode. One thing that, Evan, you might have not realized, that when you did those interviews, I think every single person referred to the Blackjack Brawl as a pay-per-view. And it is not. It was on Sports Channel America, free cable. It was never a pay-per-view, but because, like, who in the right mind would put an event at the MGM Grand on free cable? None of these guys 25 years later realized that this was just available for anyone to watch. And then the kicker on that is that the people, if you were one of the 500 people who wanted to watch the Blackjack Brawl at home, you couldn't for the first 10 minutes because it was preempted for a preseason hockey game on Sports Channel. So if you look on YouTube, there's a version of the Blackjack Brawl that is the original taped from when it aired. And that version, you can see them interrupting mid-match as, like, we join you in the process of the Blackjack Brawl.
Amazing.
Well, let's talk about, we've talked about some of the folks who were in the business. What about Howard the person, or Herb the person? I'm going to continue to do this now that Evan's put this in my head subconsciously. Talk to me about, Herb the man, Herb the family man. Did you meet any of Herb's family through the course of these interviews?
Yeah, so I'll quickly just say I was able to track down, first of all, Herb's one of Herb's wives. So Herb had two wives, and one of them that all the guys talk about, I was able to track her down. I gave her a phone call, and I think in the history of this show, it was the fastest hang-up I've received in two seasons. It was like, I'm doing this documentary. It's about Herb Abrams. I believe you were married to him. Click. End of conversation. The main thing about this is, so far, Evan and Jason have talked about this, but for our show, we really like to talk about, like, we like to talk to family members and the people who are affected by these crazy events outside of professional wrestling. And for Herb, again, because he's sort of a mystery in the wrestling world and he died before the internet really took off, there isn't too much information about that side of him. And we were able to, I'm just going to mention, there's a guy named Jonathan Plumpton who is writing a book. He's been writing a book for maybe like 10 years at this point about Herb Abrams. And he's truly the, like, Herb Abrams guy. And he put me in touch with a cousin of Herb's who we ended up interviewing for the episode, but didn't put it in the show. And he's like really interesting and really kind of opened it up a little bit. And he introduced me to Herb's sister, who's still alive. And Herb's sister is a very private woman, and it took me a long time to kind of build a relationship with her and get her to kind of understand what we're trying to tell with this story and just try to learn more about Herb, because there's just so little I knew about Herb. And so I ended up being able to go visit her. I went to where she lives. I don't want to name that. And I spent a few hours just talking with Herb's sister. And to me, the most fascinating thing is that she had no idea about 90% of his she knew he was in wrestling. She knew he had a promotion, but like the Blackjack Brawl, I was like, hey, do you remember when Herb did this? He had the MGM Grand in Las Vegas. She has no idea. Never heard of that forever before. And he definitely kept that part private, but like everyone else, Herb scammed his family, and his sister, Herb stole her identity, and it took her years afterwards to be able to deal with credit card companies and the IRS because he was able to make credit cards in her name and then run them up. And like everyone else, she still loves him and thinks the world of him, but it was very challenging for her. And she mentioned to me how when after Herb died, they were at their mother's house, Herb's mother's house in New York, for sitting Shiva, which, if people don't know, it's when a Jewish person dies, you go for about a week afterwards, you'll sit in their home and visit with the family. And when they were sitting Shiva, one of the nights, two men in suits knocked on the front door. And when they opened the front door to see who these people were, these two men were very clearly like looking behind and trying to just get in the house, even though they'd never known who these people were. And so Herb's sister kind of chases them, tells them to leave. And when she's trying to chase after them to get their license plate, they're out of there and just running. And basically about a week later, Herb's mother's house was broken into, and then it was broken into again. And eventually Herb's sister moved their mother out of New York because they're not sure who it was. They think it possibly could have been the mob, but they just knew that people thought Herb could be alive and wanted money from him.
Wow.
It's such a weird story because he's a character unlike anybody. I mean, this is such a business filled with crazy characters, and it feels like he takes the cake to the point that even when he passes away, there's controversy, and I'm sure there's lots of unanswered questions, and you sort of broke that down on the episode with everybody has their own version of how he passed away. But the most interesting thing is the teaser that, hey, what if he faked his own death? What do you make of all this, Evan?
Well, I was going to say, yeah, like, you know, one of the things that we tried to do when we set out, you know, to make this, to make this episode was really, I mean, one of the things that you know about Herb, if you go in, like if any wrestling fans have sort of casually heard about Herb Abrams, you've probably heard about his death, you know? So that was one of the things that definitely sold me on this being a fascinating subject for an episode of the show. But I just remember, I'm sure Howard, you remember, like I was really keen on us trying to figure out exactly what happened in that office, you know, that day in 1996. And, you know, for us, it was really tough. I mean, there are some tabloidy newspaper stories that have been written about it, but we were never really able like to verify it with any of the authorities or anything like that. Right, Howard? I mean, that's safe to say.
Yeah, it seems, I mean, the best the article that we kind of feature for a moment in the episode is kind of the only article that seems to have been written really that says this thing happened in this office. He died in the hospital. And so what seems to have happened is, everything that happened in that office, police come, they arrest him, and either he had a heart attack in the car or at some point in the process, they bring him to the hospital and he dies. But because of that, they didn't seem to do a police report. Like I put in the paperwork. I know other people I spoke to have tried to get a police report on his passing, and no one has ever come through with it. So if there is one, the New York City police don't want to share it, but it seems more likely that just nothing was written up. So it is really just hearsay and innuendo.
And because I think he's such a like larger than life, you know, person, and like the way he lived his life in terms of scamming people and skipping out on money and, you know, always trying to find an edge no matter what, I think it's opened the door for people to believe that, well, he's a prime candidate for someone to fake his own death, right? And, you know, that was something that, you know, Marty, who's in the episode, aka Colonel Red, he's one of the first interviews we did for the episode. And, you know, that was a huge factor for him was, no, this guy is still alive. I know for a fact. I can feel it, you know, basically. And so, you know, for us, it just made it even more compelling. Like even the legend of this whole thing and the I don't even know what you want to call it, but this whole like continuation of the Herb Abrams urban legend story, it has even extended on Howard. You might get mad at me for bringing this up, but
it's fine. It's fine.
Is the idea of Herb Abrams Jr., which was another crazy thing that just is part of this whole saga, is there's apparently some fellow on the internet who actually goes by Herb Abrams Jr. and has reached out and contacted several of the folks you saw in last night's episode, basically proclaiming that he's like the illegitimate son of Herb Abrams and he's like now trying to put on UWF wrestling shows. But this whole thing is like basically another scam within a scam, pretty much. And it's, you know, obviously been very traumatizing for the family and other people involved because, you know, this because as far as we know, he doesn't have any other children.
He doesn't. I'm just going to be very clear. He does not. This person is a fraud, a very easily found out fraud by my 20 minutes of research. But I think it is really speaks to the legacy of Herb that someone, I think Herb would love it, that someone pretending to be his kid. That's like, that seems like that's right up his alley.
Yeah. So just the whole rabbit hole of, you know, Herb Abrams and the UWF is just, it's just ever evolving, even in the year 2020.
Just, you know, fake sons and faking deaths. I mean, there's so much craziness surrounding this, but we saw multiple stories of guys, you know, coming in to visit Herb in his hotel room, and there being piles of cocaine and hookers. And this is probably unlike anything else you've ever had to shoot. Right, Jason?
Yeah, there was definitely like, I remember getting pitched some of the scenes from Howard that we're going to shoot and just being like, oh my God, like we got to find actors that we got to like convince to do some of these things. And luckily we found someone really cool to play Herb Abrams. I think we literally casted him. Was it like 2 days before we went to camera?
Yeah, it was something. And the last person we saw for sure.
Yeah, I remember, like, it was so hard to find someone. You wouldn't think, but it really was hard to find someone to play Herb. And the actor's name was Bobby Cole, right?
Yeah.
He came in, Howard and I sat with him, and he just instantly, like, got the energy of Herb. Like, we could just tell, like, whoa, at least this guy is just going to bring the energy. And, like, I don't even think we got to fully tell him everything that he was in for. But luckily when we were on set, he was just so in for everything. And like the farther we could go, the farther, like the more happier he was. And so he really embodied, I felt like the spirit of her.
Oh yeah. And he, when he was covered in that baby oil, you know, he was slipping and sliding all over the place and could have gotten hurt and literally, you know, he had tripped and fell, you know, and he was going for it, you know, so it was pretty spectacular.
Yeah. Thank God we found him because honestly, it just,
well, like, we know what the backup was.
What? Oh,
Evan has his backup. If he wants to share who was going to play Herb in his mind.
Who?
Me.
Oh, yes. Yeah, of course. How could I forget?
Oh my God, that's ridiculous. But yeah, there were definitely, yeah, there were some scenes like it was so ridiculous to just like watch like a bunch of guys like standing around like a set trying to figure out like what were like the best way to like to have a sex position that would feature the cowboy boots and work for the shot and get the cocaine in the shot at the same time. And like, it just, it was a sight to see for sure.
Evan, if you want to, I shared Evan photos I took of you guys acting out that sequence of trying to figure out what that would look like. So if Evan wants to share them, he can, but it's pretty, I think
when you've worked together as much as Jason and I have, you can get in any position and it'll be all right. But what I was going to say is, going back to the origin story of doing this episode, I mean, one of the main reasons that, you know, I was finally convinced to do it was the reenactment potential of this episode. I mean, like, you know, that was kind of the thing that Sean Oliver had said was like, I mean, just imagine the reenactments, you know, and that definitely was a main factor for us wanting to do this and, you know, having the challenge of doing it only because, you know, the last 24 hours of his life is so wild. And, you know, and for us, I thought that when we did the reenactments, we did kind of pull out a lot of tricks that I felt like were some of our best gags that we did in terms of all of the shoots that we've done. There was one particular shot that I just want to call out because I thought it was pretty cool. It's actually two shots. We used the same trick, which is, there's that little scene when all the TV crew is about to like hang Herb over the edge of the balcony, you know?
Yeah.
When they're like threatening him, you know, to pay. And that was just so cool because like that scene, we just didn't really know how we would shoot. And that was just literally us, you know, putting up a railing, putting the camera up high, and then putting Christmas lights on the floor to make them look like a city down below, and then just fill it full of smoke. And it kind of had that illusion of being up high over a balcony. And it really worked because, I mean, you just look at, this is just a piece of railing and some Christmas lights, but, you know, you can use that to really sell that. And then, of course, the scene where, you know, Jason, you're playing McFoley and, you know, Herb invites, you know, you up to the suite to show you his boots. And that whole scene was just, you know, decorating, you know, Christmas lights literally through a window. When you go back and you look at it, it really looks like a skyline with, you know, buildings and everything, but it's just out of focus Christmas lights. So, yeah. And that was fun.
Yeah. Like what I like too is like UWF has this kind of like this aesthetic that we could like lean into, just like, even when you look at the belt itself, the television championship belt, where it's very colorful and it has like, you know, the letters are in like yellow and green and purple. And so we like tried to use those colors as like a color palette within the episode. And that's something we found too, is like with a lot of like indie promotions, what we kind of like to dig into is like they each have their own little like aesthetic flourishes that are really kind of fun to lean into a little bit. Like even, you know, with the New Jack episode, and we introduce that promoter MWW, who has Thunder Wrestling, that like just looking at all like the designs that they created for that one little indie promotion and the color palettes that they used for it, it's just really inspired. Like they may not have known how inspired those choices were, but we really appreciate them.
I'm sure they didn't. Can we talk about Beach Brawl for just a minute? Is everyone cool with that as a transition? So, you know, Beach Brawl being the actual first and only pay-per-view that, you know, Herb Abrams did is such a fascinating part of the story, because that's definitely the turning point, I feel like, for the company. Like, had that been a little bit more successful, there might be a different story to tell. But, you know, as we know, it's one of the lowest performing pay-per-views, I think, of all time. But one fact I just wanted to throw out there that was really fun is one of the best parts of making the show, which I don't think we've really talked about, is actually, or I should say one of the more fun parts, is when we do the actual voiceover narration with Chris Jericho is really fun, because, you know, the episode's finished. And, you know, he's basically in the booth recording the narration, and he's actually recording it along with a video track. So we actually get to see all the scene that leads up to whatever line he's about to record. And as soon as we got into the Beach Brawl portion of the UWF story, when he was laying down the voiceover, he let this slip, which I thought was such a funny story, which is Chris Jericho and Lance Storm, you know, they were buddies from going way back. They actually were such big wrestling fans at the time that they actually ordered the Beach Brawl pay-per-view. So they might have been like one of 100 people that actually ordered this thing. And he was talking about how when they got it, the like audio didn't work or something, like in the feed. Maybe they were getting it through some pirate situation or something. I'm not sure, but the audio didn't work. So Chris Jericho and Lance Storm actually decided at that moment in time to record their own wrestling commentary to the whole Beach Brawl. So somewhere out there, presumably in Lance Storm's collection, hopefully, is a VHS tape with Chris Jericho and Lance Storm doing commentary on the Beach Brawl. So that needs to be found. Yeah, which is amazing. And then the other thing that's really funny is that the Beach Brawl took place at the Manatee Civic Center in Palmetto, Florida. And Chris also told us that the very first Nitro that he ever wrestled was at the Manatee Civic Center in Palmetto, Florida. And the funny thing is when he showed up to the actual Nitro, he just walks in and he just like takes it all in. And the only thing he's thinking is, wow, this is where the Beach Brawl was, you know, which is amazing, you know. So that's just a fun little anecdote of the crossover of UWF and Chris Jericho.
Well, let's put a bow on this one. There's so much research that goes into a show like this. Tell me what you wish could have made air that maybe didn't make air, Howard.
Honestly, I can go on for an hour about that. I'm going to do two quick things. One is the Steve Ray, who we've talked about a little bit. He, when I kind of pre-interviewed, when I first reached out to him, he told me a longer version of the story that he tells about Herb jumping out the window, which this is all alleged, I have to say. It is alleged, but it is pretty crazy. Full story is that Herb contracted a number of girls from Heidi Fleiss in Los Angeles, the legendary madam. And Herb and Steve were going to a golf tournament in Palm Springs they were the special guests of Kenny Baker, who you'll all know as R2-D2 from Star Wars. So it's Herb Abrams, Steve Ray, R2-D2, and a number of call girls at a golf tournament in Palm Springs. And that is the site of where Herb tried to get people to take a check, and they did not take the check, and goons allegedly were sent after him. So
I do have to just interject that maybe not everyone knows, or maybe I'm just ignorant, that, you know, R2-D2, the actual droid itself, you know, was piloted by a little person with no legs.
No, he had legs. He was just a little person.
I don't know where. Yeah. I guess I don't know what I'm talking about. Sorry, guys. He had legs. Go on.
But yeah, so Kenny Baker, the man who played R2-D2, who passed a few years ago, was involved in Herb Abrams. There's the weird amount of celebrities that you hear. Like, there's a story how William Shatner went to his office once and he knew him. Tiny Tim was another person. Just all these guys who got into Herb's orbit. And one of the guys who got into Herb's orbit that people probably don't know about is a man named Zugs Rift. And Zug's Rift was kind of a Frank Zappa sort of experimental musician, and he really wanted to get into wrestling. And he kind of in the later era of the UWF got involved with Herb, and he was one of the people funding him for a little bit of time. And there's an amazing video online. You can find it on YouTube on archive.org. And I think it's called UWF Rampage. And it's from the show in North Dakota that the legend is that Zugs put it out, and it's a mix of the actual show with like weird B-roll. Like the tape starts with John Tolis, the legendary wrestler and manager, not realizing he's being filmed and talking about all the lesbians in the crowd and how there's a ton of lesbians in North Dakota. There's footage of a press conference where Herb is going off, where there's maybe eight people in the audience and most of them are children. There's Steve Ray on the back of a truck yelling at people. It's just like one of the weirdest things in wrestling that I've seen. And I want to direct people to it because it's pretty outstanding. And then on top of it all, Zug's Rift's son, Aaron, who I believe is a wrestling writer, he recently put out a video of YouTube of Zugs talking about Herb and his experience. And in that video, he included a scan of a flyer for the event that they were trying to put on after the Blackjack Brawl, which never happened. And this is the first I ever heard about this. This was maybe 2 days ago. And one of the scheduled matches was a psycho aquatic torture match between Cactus Jack and Sabu.
Yeah, we actually asked Mick about that the other day, and he has no recollection of it. So I'm sure that was just another con job. But Mick, because Mick, I think by that point was having WWE conversations around 96. And that's what he was telling us the other day. But yeah, just wild.
We have a Boneyard match. I want the psycho aquatic torture match. That's all I want.
Seriously, tell Bruce.
My goodness. Well, this is one for the ages, man. Maybe one of the more fun episodes. I hate that we're talking about an ending like this. That was fun, but I don't know another word to describe it. It just feels like nonstop craziness from the front to the back. Jason, any other final words about this rather unique character in the story of Dark Side of the Ring?
Oh, gosh. You know, like Evan was saying before, you know, the story just keeps, you know, it just keeps building on like a snowball, and it's I feel like there's still stories that will come out of the woodwork about Herb Abrams, and I want to know more about that book that's being made as well too. That's something I think a lot of us are going to want to get our hands on when that eventually comes out.
Yeah, I think that the saga of the UWF could definitely be its own season of Dark Side of the Ring, for sure. I mean, this was just, you know, for us, like, you know, Gino Hernandez, that episode in season one, it's a very similar experience where, you know, it's one of the stories that we didn't really know that much about when we went in. And going into this, and like every week, every day, there felt like there was a new bizarro detail or some new crazy twist to the story or some wild perspective that we hadn't gotten. And that's really the most fun I think we have making the show, is kind of looking at these more deeper cut, you know, B-side stories that we can really just go full force into. And I think that was what's really cool about seeing it last night, was just, you know, people kind of discovering the story. And, you know, wrestling fans might not have known Herb Abrams before last night, but now they definitely will. And I think now that we've, you know, hopefully we can create some more Herb Abrams scholars out of last night's episode, and we can get some more information unearthed and some more firm, hard, confirmed details about the way he passed. And who knows, or maybe someone will find that he's alive and we don't know what the hell is going on in the first place. But definitely one of the more fun, wild experiences we had making the show. And it was just,
Howard, I think people are going to want to know if there's any other info about Cokie the dog.
Yes.
So one thing we cut from the episode, I can quickly say how Herb would bring Cokie. He'd leave him in the limo when they would go to a steakhouse, and then he would make them at the steakhouse make a steak for Cokie and bring it out to the limo. And then the other great thing about Cokie is he, so Herb's company was called NGK Productions, and NGK apparently stood for, I don't know what the N is, but G was Gucci and K was Cokie. They were all names of his dogs. And so in case he got sued, the company would actually be in his dog's name. So that is my little Cokie info. Wow.
Thank you.
The company was in the dog's name.
I mean, you just, as soon as I found out that Herb's dog's name was Cokie, I felt like it really endeared me. That was the one bit of info that sold me on Herb. That'd be like, well, maybe I might have liked Herb, you know, because that's funny. That means he's self-aware a little bit, right?
I don't know what it means, but it means that this is the best show on wrestling. I can't believe that we've been blessed with this episode. Thank you guys for all your hard work. This is the only episode that I had to watch 3 times. It's just such a phenomenal story. And I'm looking forward to next week. Evan, give everybody an idea of what we're in store for.
That's right. Next week's episode is all about the Road Warriors. You know, this is one of the only episodes of the show where a wrestler sought us out and called us out. And Animal found us when I was at Actual StarCast, when I was there. Animal really was a big fan of the show, and he felt that, you know, he would love to tell the real story of the Road Warriors. And that, and obviously Jason and I have grown up, you know, as huge Road Warriors fans as kids. Yeah. I mean, you honestly, I challenge you to find anything, to show me anything that is cooler than the Road Warriors entrance in the mid-80s with Iron Man pumping and these guys coming out to the ring, jumping the ring with spikes. I mean, there isn't anything cooler than that. So
it's, you know, literally Jason, the greatest image I think humankind has ever come up with.
Like, yeah.
Look at it. It's just so captivating.
Yeah.
And it always has. Like, for Evan and I, we've got like all the action figures. I'm literally sitting here in a fucking Road Warriors hoodie right now. Like, I'm just,
yeah, they should be. Yeah, they got to get the Road Warriors up in the space capsule, you know, for the aliens to find. Yeah. But, you know, for us, it was a huge, like, you know, since they were such a huge part of us growing up as kids, and because there is such a fascinating story behind this tag team. I mean, this is kind of a story we wanted to look at in terms of, like, you know, it's all about identity. You know, when Hawk passed away, you know, it kind of left a lot for Animal to reckon with, you know, and what his own identity was. And that was a really kind of compelling story for us, like to look at kind of fallen brotherhood in wrestling and, you know, really look at one of the most iconic tag teams in wrestling history. So it was a huge excuse to tell that story. And it was also a huge excuse for Jason and I to get our own set of pads that we wore. And and we also recreated the Starcade steps, which I'm sure we'll talk about next week. Yeah. Which was a very important thing for us. And yeah, this was a huge, like, you know, exploration and aesthetic for us, because it's just such a huge part of us when we were kids growing up loving wrestling.
Are you guys hard right now? It feels like you guys are popping boners just talking about this episode next week.
I mean,
you'll definitely see we like fetishize the hell out of the Road Warriors.
Yeah. I mean, remember we talked about the chain videos, Conrad.
Oh, this no, is just, I know. These all, are... I know all about the chain videos, and I know how excited you were at StarCast in Vegas when you got to throw the shoulder pads on. And yeah, listen, I'm excited to see it. I think everybody listening to this grew up as a fan of the Road Warriors. And next week we get to explore the good, the bad, and the ugly of some pretty talented performers, one of which is no longer with us. So stay tuned. It's Tuesday night, 10 p.m. Eastern. I get it on my DirecTV. I know it's on Dish Network. Be sure to check your local cable listings. But tune in next Wednesday. We're going to break down Dark Side of the Ring, the Road Warriors edition, right here on Dark Side of the Podcast. You know, listen, every week I tell you that I can save you some money at SaveWithConrad.com, but I decided this week, let's do something a little different. Don't take my word for it. Let's read some 5-star reviews that were just left this month for SaveWithConrad.com. Christopher in Indiana says the process was painless and easy, direct communication and quick responses to questions throughout the process. Honest advice put me in a position to save tons of money and pay off my mortgage quicker. Charles from Ohio. Jimmy is what made it great. He answered every one of my stupid questions with patience and grace. Randall from Ohio. Awesome. Right from the start, being out of state was no issue. First Family made everything super easy and convenient. They were available before, during, and after business hours. I cannot say enough good things. Brian from Missouri. Everyone was terrific to deal with. Jimmy was very professional and super easy to deal with. He answered all of our questions promptly and accurately. I would recommend Jimmy to anyone I know. Michael from West Virginia. Everyone was professional and made the whole process easy. The entire process took a month, and every step of the way, someone was available when I had questions. Just an awesome company. Thomas from Tennessee. Derek was great to work with and made the experience easy and always reliable, always available to answer questions. Neil from Florida. Fast, friendly, knowledgeable. Randall from Ohio. Awesome right from the start. Being out of state was no issue. Steven from Ohio. Simple, fast, no issues, and blew my previous mortgage company out of the water with great customer service and were always quick to get back to me whenever I had questions. Robert from Indiana. Easy to keep in contact. I was able to use email and text messages for most of the deal, which made this very easy to get done. 5 stars. John from Ohio. I love the texting and easy communication from this mortgage team. Closing was simple and awesome as well. Brendan from Arizona gave us 5 stars and said, great communication, great response times, just an overall great experience. Austin from Florida says, huge listener of Conrad's podcast, and everything he says is true. He can help you save money and take years off of your loan. Jimmy was great to work with. Amazingly painless experience compared to others I've had. Thank you very much. And no, I should be thanking you guys. First of all, thanks for listening to the podcast. And second, thanks for trusting me enough to have a shot at saving you some money. But most of all, thank you for your business. And I hope you enjoy all of the savings that we provided for your family. But if you're listening to this and you haven't gone to savewithconrad.com yet, what are you waiting for? We're licensed in more than 40 states. You don't need perfect credit or money out of your pocket. And if we can't help you save money, we won't waste your time. But if you've got a 30-year loan, if you've got a second mortgage, if you've got credit card debt, you're overpaying your single biggest bill and you may not realize it. We're going to show you how to get the best interest rate possible and skip a couple of house payments. But in the process, you're going to save hundreds of dollars per month. And more importantly, pay your house off faster with cheaper monthly payments. If you're serious about keeping more of your own money and getting out of debt faster, retiring on time, and eliminating your credit card debt, you should hurry to savewithconrad.com. Find out how much money you can save for free right now. NMLS number 65084, Equal Housing Lender, savewithconrad.com.
When you have sports mixed with your pop culture, along with humor and celebrity interviews, your earbuds are enjoying the Rich Eisen Show.
Kevin Millar, we're all paying rent in Ohtani's world, right?
And the Dodgers world. Game is healthy. Game is good. And, you know, I get asked a lot, is that good for baseball? Yeah, it's good for baseball. This is definitely the team to beat, because that should be your next question, Richie, is that, is this World Series a bust for the Dodgers and Dave Roberts?
Hell yeah.
Search for the Rich Eisen Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.